This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, Dark Times for Black Folk, an assessment of the Black condition. Private corporations make out like bandits in the Georgia criminal justice system. And Mumia Abu-Jamal on the Civil Rights Act 50 years later. But first, the unpopular government of Haiti talks endlessly about preparing for elections, but shows no signs of allowing the participation of Family Lavalasse, the party of former President Jean Bertrand Aristide, whose democratically elected government was overthrown by a U.S.-backed coup in 2004. We spoke with Pierre Labossiere, a co-founder of the Haiti Action Committee.
In Haiti, we see all the game playing that's taking place. But I can say that ever since 2000, the world powers, imperialist powers, have always maneuvered so that the people of Haiti are removed from having any voice in the decision-making of what's going on in their country. And that includes elections. And the coup d'etat of 2004 was the most blatant of these attempts to stifle the voices of people in terms of the democratic process, in terms of voting or participating in the running of their countries. And so what we saw that in 2006, the elections that took place under occupation, it took the massive outpouring of people into the streets, really, to prevent a theft of the elections, and the people massively made their voices count. But since then, they have gotten very sophisticated in their attempts, more sophisticated in their attempts to set stifle the voices. And so what we saw in 2009, blatantly, the U.S. government exercised its power and its overarching influence in Haiti directly to encourage the Prevost administration, according to various reports, to block Family Lavalasse from participating. And they used various strategies and schemes that were very apparent to everybody, that were very obvious. That was in 2009. The same thing happened in 2010. And as a result, in 2009, people massively boycotted the elections. And very few people participated, less than 5%, according to various reports. And in 2010, for the presidential elections, less than 20% of the population participated. But despite that, there was all kinds of widespread fraud, and it was really a selection of President Martelly, and that's what has happened. So, and they are so blatant and so out there with it, and it's a sorry state of affairs that internationally, the so-called international community, and what I mean by that is the countries of the world have recognized this illegitimate, this Michel Martelly as the legitimate president of Haiti, coming out of such a blatantly fraudulent process in which the majority of the people of Haiti didn't participate. So right now, as we are looking at this background, Haiti is under occupation. The same forces that have stifled the voices of the Haitian people for the past 10 years with the coup d'etat and the kidnapping coup d'etat of President Aristide, they are the ones in charge, and nothing shows that they want to do the same thing in terms of keeping the people out of the decision-making process and the electoral process and the democratic process, the everyday democratic process that is supposed to occur in a society where human beings live. Because after all, they are the ones to make the decisions that affect their very lives. They are the ones who are supposed to decide how the resources of the country are going to be used, what schools to be built, hospitals that are needed, tools for our farmers to work the land, to produce food, and all the infrastructure that needs to be built to make a decent life for the people of Haiti.
deposed President Aristide has been back in Haiti for several years. He, of course, was virtually kidnapped by the United States in 2004 and taken off to the Central African Republic and lived in exile for a number of years. But here in the United States, we don't hear much, if anything, about what he's doing on the ground in Haiti or what Lavalas, the party he founded, is doing.
President Aristide, since his return in March of 2011, he has been very active. On September 2011, he reopened the medical school that had been shut down by the U.S., French, and Canadian Special Forces. Imagine a medical school with the medical needs of the Haitian population to shut it down, kicking out 248 medical students. That's what that suppose invasion to have Haiti be a nation of democracy. That's what they had done. And so when he came back, he reopened the medical school and started bringing in students from various impoverished communities in Haiti, half men, half women, first class of about 122 students. And now the medical school is continuing, and there is also a nursing school has been added, and now there is also a law school. And so there are approximately about close to 900 students altogether, and also some computer science program has been added. So this is what he has been doing, focusing very much in education, which he's an educator. And the people of Haiti, President Aristide remains, is more popular now than ever before. You see, if you can believe that, he was very popular before when he was kidnapped by the U.S. Special Forces and the French and Canadians participating in it with the U.N. And so he continues, his popularity is ever increasing. And for me, Lavalas itself as the party, for me, Lavalas was birthed by the Haitian People's Movement, by the grassroots movement, the movement of the overwhelming majority of the people of Haiti, the democratic movement of the people of Haiti. And the party came out of that. And so people very strongly identify with it. And so what the party, from reports I'm getting, have been doing is providing a forum for debate, for discussion, trying for people to have at least a place where they can at least have a forum to have various community discussions as to which way to go, how they can tackle the issues affecting the country, how do they make their voices be heard, how to deal with this situation, resist the fact that people are trying to take away their voices and determining things that are really not for their good, actually to their detriment, destroying the agriculture of Haiti, destroying the economic life of the people of Haiti, the land grabs that are taking place. Right now, there are a number of islands, particularly Île Vache and Lagunave, and also in Île de la Tortue. And there are many other parts of Haiti where there are natural resources, where there is gold and copper and other mines that foreign economic forces are trying to take over these lands. And they come up with stratagems about tourism. They are bringing jobs. If I may, let me tell you a little bit, because Lavache, here the people live from farming and fishing. So here they want to take their land completely, throw them out into the streets, supposedly to bring them jobs. But what jobs are they going to bring them? Jobs to be waiters in some resort when the people are already employed. You see, what it shows is the way they devalue the way the people live their lives. They devalue their own worth. These are people who are providing jobs for themselves and functioning, have never needed the assistance, really, of the government. And when the government really comes down, it's really to create havoc and to destroy their lives. And this is happening in a number of places. So this is an outrage. And the community, when they are resisting that, they are being jailed, they are beaten up, and it's a terrible thing. And that's what's going on.
Sweet Nikki Martelli, the U.S.-backed president and former entertainer in Haiti, is known to want to bring back the Haitian army, which has been responsible over generations for the killing of many, many, many tens of thousands of Haitians. What evidence is there that he's trying to remilitarize the country?
Well, there is a lot of evidence, not only his pronouncements, his stated determination to do so on numerous occasions, but also We've had recently, and it's shameful, that the country of Ecuador has been collaborating and supporting this effort by President Martelly. Actually, they had sent two groups of people to be trained as soldiers to restore the Haitian military, to restore that. And there are a number of former military officers who are very close with President Martelly and are part of the government. And so they are bragging about it. Ecuador has been, and it's shameful that these countries of South America are participating, and many of them who bragged about being socialists or leftists or progressives are actually supporting right-wing and ultra-right-wing government. And the Haitian people do not want the military, the Haitian military. We know it too well. We've been so victimized by it. And it was an instrument, and people shouldn't confuse the Haitian military that the Haitian people are opposed to with the Haitian people when they took up arms against Napoleon, broke the chains of slavery, and defeated the troops. Some of them are trying to confuse the two. No, one of them was a people's army, was a people defending their land, was a people fighting for their own defense. The other one was actually created by the U.S. during the U.S. military intervention in Haiti in 1915. It wasn't created by the people to defend their land. It was created by a foreign invasion to actually defend the interest of the foreigners who had taken over the land and the country of the people of Haiti. So that military that Sutnecki, President Martelly, is talking about restoring is the military that will continue to do the work of destroying the livelihood of the people of Haiti in support of foreign interests. That's what they are trying. And it's shameful that Ecuador has been the main, both Ecuador and Brazil, but the training is taking place in Ecuador. Brazil is participating. And I'll have to say that with the financial support of Venezuela, Venezuela has been one of the countries that's been really providing a lot of support, financial support to the government of Haiti. And a lot of that money was being used towards that purpose as well, of restoring the Haitian military. And this is various reports. Some are denying that. But nevertheless, this is something that the people of Haiti are taking very seriously and are very angry about that situation.
Cuba continues to provide medical support for the Haitian people. You're not opposed to that, of course.
Yes, there is a Cuban medical brigade there, and support that the Haitian people need, that are determined by the Haitian people to be helpful for their lives, for their livelihood, that's well and good until we can really get things going in Haiti. But really, the main support that Haiti needs, it's support for the liberation of our people from these forces that are keeping us so under the boots, under this grinding poverty, under this grinding misery. And the kind of support that we need is to call out these situations that are oppressing our people, is to denounce this repressive system that has been imposed on the people of Haiti since the kidnapping coup d'etat of President Aristide. But projecting the Haitian people as if, oh, we can't do anything for ourselves, as if we need a handout from everyone, this is not the kind of support we need at all, because it's misrepresenting the situation. Now, granted that everyone in this world, when disaster strikes or something happens to you, yes, we all need a helping hand. We all need something initially to prime the pump, so to speak. But we just need a little priming and then allow us to develop our own resources. But what's going on is all of this mask conspiracy that's afoot to really rob the country of its resources, rob the people of their own capacity to decide what to do with their resources. But then you're projecting the image abroad as if, oh, they can't do anything for themselves. They need to be spoon-fed unless we are there to hold their babies and give their babies a little milk. Then the mother cannot feed her own baby. You see, and this is what's being projected out there. And unfortunately, this is the kind of image that so many are presenting, and it's not helping at all the people of Haiti. It's not helping at all our struggle for liberation and self-determination.
So you're saying that Haiti's first need is to recover its national sovereignty?
That's correct. Our national sovereignty, and also our people are always producing. we are producing, but we need the support so that we can produce for ourselves. And what I mean by the support is the political support. For example, a Haitian peasant doesn't have the kind of government support in terms of infrastructure so that their production can provide for their families. You have a sense, basically, when you look at the situation, that the Haitian state is at war against its very productive, the very productive forces in the country. All of that to benefit imports. So imports or production from abroad are given preferential treatment over production inside the country. And so it's as if the Haitian state is carrying out a war against its very own people inside Haiti. The number of marketplaces, every once in a while there is a fire. The stock, the inventory of the people are burned down. And rarely does anybody get some kind of compensation for that. Credit is not really available to the people unless it's under terms similar to sharecropping that really put the people in dire misery, in worse misery than they started before. So a number of irrigation systems are not being kept up. So there is no real investment to help spur the people at the grassroots level so that their produce can actually get to market fast and in a way that will protect their investment. And so those are the many layers of the problem. And really what you have is a government that is at war against its people. And when the people do elect a government that is really tending to their needs, that is doing what a government should do, meaning managing the resources so that the population can benefit in a way that will help it improve its livelihood, then that government is taken out by the imperialist forces, U.S., France, and Canada, as happened in 2004. And that's what continually, and it happened before that in 1991. And that's what we are seeing in Haiti. So this is the crux of the matter. This is what needs to be exposed.
The actual military occupation of Haiti is carried out by MINUSTAH, the United Nations' so-called peacekeeping forces. Peacekeeping, there's no war in Haiti. What peace are they keeping?
That's what Haitians are wondering, what's going on there. And to us, MINUSTAH is no more than a replacing of the former Haitian military, who the people had massively and overwhelmingly rejected. And when President Aristide came to office, when he came back from the first coup, he listened to the voices of the people, and the Haitian military was disbanded. It used to eat 40% of our national budget. 40% of the budget was going into that. The people determined, rightfully, they made the decision that that money should go into building schools and hospitals, and we were seeing big changes occurring in Haiti, because when this money was redirected to benefit the population and answer to their needs. And so MINUSTAH has been there really in replacement of the old military to impose that neoliberal structure, to impose the policies of those foreign governments who want to extract the wealth from Haiti, who want to steal our resources, plunder the country, and impose their will on the people. And MINUSTAH has been their enforcers, their goon squads. And it's a shame to see so many countries, again, progressive nations throughout the Americas and other countries who are there in Haiti, who have actually participated in massacres against the people of Haiti. It's shameful. It's shameful. But they are glossing over that. These issues are not being raised. Yet everybody is pointing out, oh, look at those black folks in Haiti, as if there is not a war that has been ongoing against our people.
Pierre Labossiere of the Haiti Action Committee, speaking from the San Francisco Bay Area. Last week at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, black academics and activists came together for a workshop on black sovereignty, citizenship, and freedom. The event was convened by Vanderbilt professors Peter Hudson and Jemima Pierre under the title Black Folk in Hard Times. Author and activist Kevin Alexander Gray from Columbia, South Carolina, led off the discussion.
Let me say, from the perspective of looking at things in the context of citizenship and in the context of what I do for a living in South Carolina as a community organizer, living in a place where I've grown up, being in a place like South Carolina that's so tied to the history of this country, where a majority, from black South Carolinians' perspective, majority of Africans came in through Sullivan's Island, which is our Ellis Island, a state that's so tied to the idea of states' rights, tied to the idea of white supremacy, tied to the ideology of the Confederacy, tied to the ideology that has brought us of white supremacy and white privilege, that has brought us to the southernization of American politics in America today, from the so-called Southern Strategy that was implemented by Harry Dent through Lee Atwater, through Richard Nixon, all South Carolina products, to the Dixiecrats and Strom Thurmond. It's just by a quirk of history that my father was from South Carolina, and I'm there, where a flag flies, a Confederate flag flies on the State House grounds, where, of course, in recent news, the College of Charleston hires a Confederate reenactor as its president, which is par for the course in that Edward Rutledge, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, refused to sign the Declaration until the anti-slavery clause was taken out. So I feel kind of fortunate in a way to be in the original slave state, but it does present a whole lot of challenges. But it does remind me, and I just did a review of Greg Grandin's book, The Empire of Necessity, for the Progressive. And as I was talking about the Confederate flag and the new president of the College of Charleston and the idea that capitalism, the fulcrum of capitalism, is the enslavement of Africans. So I've always felt very fortunate to be in a state that, although it does get on your nerves at times because we have the reenactors and we have full-time Confederates, that South Carolina is the root of it. So when you see the attack on Medicaid expansion or on the ACA, which is it certainly isn't universal health care, and I don't want to promote it as being anything but a giveaway to big corporations ultimately, but the expansion of Medicare is the expansion of the idea of universal health care. And so when you have government officials that block those kinds of things because they feel as though they are blocking things to keep niggas down, that's their politics. Now, Barack Obama, on the surface, may be the victims of those attacks, but in his 6 years in office, he has sure enough catered to those forces. And that, I guess, is where we are today. I've been writing a book with the working title, The Decline of Black Politics from Malcolm X to Barack Obama, since Barack Obama's been in office. I really started on the book 20 years ago after I did work with Jesse Jackson's campaign, in which Reverend pretty much ensconced black power into the Democratic Party and party politics and locked us in with an elite black representation that's often sponsored by the same forces that we fought for years and years. But even so, as a community activist, my job is to try to stay local. It used to be, think locally, act globally. For me, it's always been think locally. And to try to give people a sense of their options, try to talk about what's left out of the conversation, try to talk about what's helping or hurting the community, to try to talk about community and politics in the sense of self-defense. How can we mitigate what white power, what white supremacy, what white privilege does? How do we mitigate what those folk that would buy into that do to our community? And with the idea that we didn't just vote, especially as in regards to Barack Obama, we didn't vote ourselves into this current state. He's there, but we didn't vote ourselves into it, and we're not going to vote ourselves out of it. Mm-hmm. Voting's part of it, but the hard organizing has to start, and it has to start at the local level and figuring out how do you change the consciousness of people? How do you get them fully involved? How do you identify with the problems that they're facing? So if you're talking about the drug war and the school-to-prison pipeline, you try to find where people are. How do they enter into that system, be it through disorderly conduct charges, which in my state is how most people get introduced to the system, or when we talk about stand your ground, all these new noise ordinances where police have carte blanche to stop a kid, or laws that fine kids for wearing their pants hanging down on a $500 fine for wearing your pants hanging below your belt in some municipalities. Finding out where people are and operating from that perspective. How do we increase voter participation? Because in the South, voting's not the whole thing, but black folks in the South vote Democratic because their representatives are Democratic and the people come out of their community. So how do you really change the nature of those folk from being so tied to the power structure and forgetting why you sent them? Those are the kinds of things I do and try to organize people to be prepared to file the lawsuits, to be prepared to march if you have to be prepared to run if you have to. Right now, what we're seeing in the South is a breakdown of all those organizations that we used to have that protected our rights. Now, some of them weren't that great in the first place. The NAACP, very male-oriented, very church-oriented, very sexist leadership. We see it changing on the national level, but we don't see it changing on the local level. It's getting old. Young folk are online. Young folk are tweeting. But young folk aren't going to meetings. So how do you engage people? The Voting Rights Act, which is under attack in, well, all across the country, and it's not like it hasn't been under attack for a long, long time. How do we organize, fight back against that? How do we fight against school privatization? How do we fight against school privatization in the face of a president that supports school privatization when it leads to an elite structure and a more segregated structure? How do we fight against gentrification when in cities like Atlanta or Charlotte or my city, Columbia, or in New York with Brooklyn, where you've got some of the people that folk look up to promoting the gentrification that's ultimately going to disenfranchise and disempower a whole lot of people, that push poor people to the boundaries, that push poor people out to where they're invisible? How do we fight against that? And I say you have to come up with new structures, not just the NAACP and relying on the churches and the ministers, who the ministers always get a whole lot more credit than they deserve. But how do we start the Freedom Schools, and how do we engage people, and how do we get them funded, and how do we make them to where they're independent of the marketplace? And how do we talk about ideology? It's easy for us in an academic environment to talk about socialism and Marxism, but go out on the street and talk about it when people are faced with blingism and shiny things and seeing on TV everybody living a high life. It takes talking about cooperative economics in a way that they understand it, and about talking about sustainable economics. How do you get people to understand that maybe you ought not go in the military and kill people overseas, and that your government's willing to spend $1.5 million per troop per tour, but they can't even pay for an education, your higher education, and if you get one, you're in debt almost for the rest of your life. But that takes engaging people in a different kind of way. It takes building new structures, Freedom Schools. It takes organizations and entities like the Black Agenda Report and all those independent news outlets out there. It takes people willing to come back to the community and share their stories. It takes being involved with people where their needs are. So what comes next? I hope what comes next is some real hardcore organizing. Right now we've been doing the Moral Monday and Truthful Tuesday protest on Medicaid expansion throughout North, South Carolina, and Georgia, although there is a little bit of worry because we've got leadership from organizations where it is about ego and it is about creating that new black leader, so that's always a problem. How do we deal with what's going on in the prison system? How do we attack the war on drugs and the war on black people and get the black community just to stop talking about racial profiling but talk about drug legalization and ending drug prohibition? And how do we deal with the fact that there's a rise in private for-profit community colleges that kids can't afford that send them into dead-end jobs? Those are the things that we ought to be concerned about. As far as the Obama administration is concerned, 2.5 more years to go. And like many, I hope in the room, I'd be very glad to see that 2.5 year end to where we bought into this idea of endless war. We buy into this idea of star chambers where people are denied due process. And we have a corporate president and a corporate ideology that doesn't seem to be getting us anywhere.
That was Kevin Alexander Gray, author of Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics.
Dr. Christina Sharp is a professor of English at Tufts University. She spoke on the past and present black condition.
We're here today because each of the panelists is in agreement that we are in dark times for black people and that the crises that we are facing everywhere are numerous and staggering. It's not a given to be in the company of people for whom the predicament of blackness, quote, and black people's a given. So I'm thankful to Jemima Pierre and Peter Hudson for convening us. It's an honor for me to be here with you today. So how do we understand black folk in dark times? First and foremost, for me, it necessitates the recognition of the necessity of black death as the very condition of possibility for those who would claim a right to the terms that follow the colon in the title of today's symposium, sovereignty, citizenship, freedom. It means a recognition that the black folk in hard times who occupy the space before the colon destabilize the terms that come after the colon for black people, though not only for black people. So we black folk in dark times are living in the wake of slavery, living what Hartman calls the afterlife of property, living the afterlife of partus sequitur ventrum, in which the child inherits the non-slash status of the mother, the non-being of the mother, and that's everywhere apparent now in the criminalization of black women and children. To be black folk in dark times means living the disastrous effects of the policies of the first U.S. black president, who, again, I echo the desire for these 2.5 years to conclude. It means the gratuitous violence of stop and frisk and Operation Clean Halls, rates of incarceration that boggle the mind, the imminence of death as a, quote, predictable and constitutive aspect of this democracy, end quote. It means living the history and the present of terror as the ground of our everyday black existence. It means living the history and present of terror as the ground of our everyday black existence. It means living a historical slash discontinuous but always present and always reinvigorated presence of terror in and on our bodies at the same time that the realities of terror are erased from our bodies. Who else can weaponize sidewalks, shoot themselves while handcuffed? It means living in and with terror in the ways in which much of what passes for discourse about terror names we, black people, as the carriers of terror, terror's embodiment, an internal, the internal terroristic threat, and not the primary objects of terror's multiple enactments. So here I want to think the grounds of terror's possibility in and outside of the U.S., and here a sort of aside is thinking about Robert Gibbs' comments on the drone murder of 16-year-old U.S. citizen Abdurrahman al-Awlaki, in which he says, quote, I would suggest that you should have a far more responsible father if you are truly concerned about the well-being of your children, end quote. I want to put that up against Barack Obama's reprimands to black men in the U.S. to be responsible fathers, to locate black people in the U.S. as the sort of grounds of terrorism, as the always already killable. So I was asked to build on the work of Monstrous Intimacies, which was my first book, and to speak today about the problematic of black citizenship in contemporary film and visual culture and their significance in shaping the terms of contemporary black political life. Among other things, I was interested in that book in thinking through the multiple ways that the incorporation, redemption, or, quote, elevation of some black people to positions of relative power or privilege, often through their traumatic proximity to whiteness as violation, which then gets rewritten as something like pleasure, allowed the continued subjection of all black people to be written as freedom or as some kind of access route to something like freedom. I wrote at the end of the introduction to that book that I meant, quote, for Monstrous Intimacies to intervene in and to position us to see and think anew what it means to be a black post-slavery subject, positioned within everyday intimate brutalities, who is said to have survived or to be surviving the past of slavery that is not yet past, bearing something like freedom, end quote. So I would amend that to say that is bearing a belief in freedom, even as that freedom, the third contested term, post-colon, is largely freedom claimed for and by non-black others, a space claimed and defended particularly by those constituted as white, who then imagine themselves as free of the subjection writ largest on black bodies. In Red, White, and Black, Cinema and the Structure of U.S. Antagonisms, Frank Wilderson reads politically engaged cinema, and he argues that what he calls slave cinema, films directed by black directors that attempt to stage ethical dilemmas that involve blacks, exploits the ruse of analogy. That is, according to Wilderson, it exploits the ruse that the suffering of black people can be analogized. Wilderson contends, and I would agree with him, that it cannot be, because we are not all claimed by life in the same way. We do not experience suffering on the same plane of conflict, since the black is characterized by gratuitous violence and not by the conflict of civil society. And we can think here of the difference between Spiller's flesh and body. So alongside the ruse of analogy is what I'm going to call, though I haven't thought this all the way through, the ruse of citizenship. And by way of example, I want to look at the ways that certain high-profile, though certainly not only high-profile, black people perform an inhabitation or possession of citizenship via their legibility to white people that they do not actually enjoy and that runs counter to all available evidence. And I'm thinking of citizenship here at the very least to mean the conferral of rights to some sort of bodily integrity, an ability to, quote, stand one's ground, the ability to move unimpeded within and through space, or, as Kevin just said, to wear one's pants however one wants, etc. So I want to look at both Atlantic Monthly columnist, I don't know how to say his name correctly, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and MSNBC host and professor Melissa Harris Perry. They come most readily to mind when I think about those high-profile black people who perform an inhabitation of citizenship that they do not actually possess. So think of Harris Perry's open letter to Edward Snowden in which she tells him, quote, it's time to come home and face the consequences of the actions of which you are so proud, end quote. And then there's Coates, whose recent columns have focused on his growing disappointment in the disciplining and disciplinary ways that Barack Obama speaks to black people. And yet mixed in with some of these truths are the markers of what I'm calling the ruse of citizenship, the will to legibility that one finds in, for example, his forgetting how he's seen, and I think it's called The Secret Lives of Inner City Black Men, he writes. He writes about trying to get a cab, and he says, and I think this is his not-to-be-taken-seriously comment, that, quote, it's sort of amazing how you think you are going to be permitted to act as Americans do and instead receive the reminder, oh, that's right, we're just some niggers. I almost forgot, end quote. Another marker is it's a recent piece called Black Pathology and the Closing of the Progressive Mind, which has been his back and forth with Jonathan Chait, right? And it's a marker in there in which his use of what he says, his commitment to French, and his use in that article of the repetition of the phrase on y va, right? Which for me is an insertion of difference, a desire for recognition, a desire to distinguish himself from those who he still uses the term sort of the culture of poverty. And I'm just going to name another recent blog post that he put up in which he invites readers to, quote, talk to me like I'm stupid as he asks for clarification on a point in his readings. So for me, these sort of displays are of cognitive dissonance. And this kind of cognitive dissonance subtends for me a ruse of black citizenship and disavows the fact that black people in the U.S. live in and as the wake of Dred Scott v. Sanford. The 1850 decision, which most of you are familiar with, by which the U.S. Supreme Court found that not only that Dred and Harriet Scott must return to slavery, but that their residence in a free state did not, in fact, make them free, that not only were, quote, Negroes beings of an inferior order so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, end quote, but that neither he nor any other person of African ancestry could claim citizenship in the United States. So I'm going to end with a few thoughts about what I've been talking about as inhabitation. And I want to think of inhabitation both as a state of being inhabited / occupied, but also being or dwelling in something. And I want to do this via the words of the visual artist Carol Walker and the novelist activist Dion Brand. In a film that I've been able to see, though it has not received U.S. distribution, by Arthur Jaffa called Dreams Are Colder Than Death, Carol Walker speaks of her most comfortable space of making work as the occupation of a space inserted between her and her skin. She speaks of it as a kind of, quote, retinal detachment. So I wanted to think about that in thinking that, of course, retinal detachment hinders one's ability to see, and untreated, it can lead to blindness. So I've written on Carol Walker's work in my first book. It's the last chapter of my first book. And I think that the kinds of detachment of which she speaks can allow powerful forces and images to sort of emerge from her and through her. But I think that they emerge only within a particular range. It's work that's produced out of a particular kind of barely tethered to her black body experience. Dion Brand, too, talks about the retina in A Map to the Door of No Return, when she says, quote, that the door of no return, and I add, hence the centrality of slavery, is on her retina, end quote. For Brand, that history's on her flesh. It's an optic that guides her way of seeing, understanding, and accounting for her place in the world. It's for Brand, the frame that produces black bodies as signifiers of enslavement and its excesses, and it's the ground that positions her, slash us, to bear the burden of that signification, and that positions some of us, and I would say that most of us in this room, to know that we bear the burden of that signification. She enables us to see it. She positions herself in it as seeing it. So in closing, I wanted to think about no citizenship. I wanted to think about the inhabitation of knowledge, of how the door, dark times, and the wake have positioned us as black people. I wanted to think about optics and retinal attachments as ways of producing embodied work, of going into communities, workplaces, etc., and doing work, of ways of seeing and imagining responses to terror in the varied and various ways that our black lives are lived under occupation, the modalities of black life lived in, as, under, and in spite of black death. I wanted to speak that we're indeed black folks in dark times, with no state to protect us, with no citizenship bound to be respected, and to position us to think and be and act from there.
Dr. Christina Sharp of Tufts University. Dr. Mabula Sumahora flew all the way from Paris to attend the workshop in Nashville. Sumahora is a professor of English at a French university and lectures on Africana studies on both sides of the Atlantic.
To take part in this conversation, I was asked to reflect on three hot topics that are very important in France right now. France being my country of birth. So those three topics are Islam, integration, and the meaning of contemporary black citizenship. So there exist multiple ways to look at France and France's black populations. It all depends on where one stands. Today, I want to focus on nowadays, dark times indeed. Beyond the international financial crisis and its impact on unemployment, housing, education, health, racism in both practices and laws, all being areas that have impacted black populations throughout the world, even during periods of brighter and happier times. So today I want to focus on the French post-colonial moment. We may hold differing views about the validity of the term post-colony and its relevance to understand the West today, but we should all agree on the previous colonial order and its logical and predominantly disastrous consequences today. Since, however, we may choose to characterize and designate those consequences, they do result from the colonial order. So beyond the Western tradition of Orientalism, the Muslim religion, which remains closely associated with North African populations and the trauma of the Algerian War that took place between 1954 and 1962, and which eventually saw the defeat of France, so the Muslim religion has been used in contemporary France as a marker of difference, foreignness, and impossible assimilation into French society. That society, thus, has reimagined itself as secular through its emphasis on the 1905 law that separated the church from the state. Words are important here, as at the time, religion was equated with the Christian church. Today, the debate over Islam, as it has unfolded in the public sphere, centers around the alleged and commonly reported direct links the religion is supposed to maintain with fundamentalism and potential terrorism. Its uncontrollable spreading and popularity, the veil, following over a decade of heated public debates, the veil was eventually banned in public schools in 2004, Subsequently, the niqab was outlawed in all public spaces in 2011. So the veil and the question of women's rights, even though this has increasingly been challenged by a new form of feminism of color, led by a younger generation of Muslim feminists who refuse the paternalism and the dominance of older white French feminists deeply anchored in self-proclaimed secularism and atheism. In the context I have just described, religion, the code for Islam, is used to have a covert conversation about race and gender. Let's just say that currently in France, Islam slash Muslim is the new black. When it comes to integration, this is the thorn, the bothering stone in France's shoe. This is the ultimate paradox, the contradiction of all contradictions. The issue is that of the emergence of a growing number of French citizens of color. This phenomenon should not be restricted to ongoing immigration and processes of naturalization. No, the emergence of French-born people of color, while Americans would call those first-generation French. The French stick to the second generation immigrants, appellation, or children of immigrants. In other words, the first of the two terms I've just mentioned designates an inescapable immigrant status passed down from parents to children, while the second term makes those children invisible. One cannot help but wonder what exactly will their status be when they grow up. Immigrants, citizens, in both cases, and despite what the law has made possible, they are never presented, imagined, or conceived as French. Who is integration for exactly? What is integration truly about when discussions, debates, public policies, and legislation around it occur in a state that has proclaimed itself, and I mean at least since 1958 and the launch of the Fifth Republic, unwaveringly blind to both color and religion? So what can actually be said about contemporary black citizenship in France? Who are the French black folk? Back in 1903, in the US context, Du Bois did not seem to hesitate the least in his understanding and conception of black folk. Please correct me if I am wrong. Who are the French black folk? This is a difficult yet necessary question that needs to be fully dealt with. In my view, Arabs and Muslims, sub-Saharan Africans, Afro-descended people born in France, people from the Caribbean, the overseas departments and territories, perhaps a new terminology of what used to be referred to as colonies. Asians of all kinds, Roma communities, are all people of color, are all black. As such, they can be viewed as blacks, that is to say, not on the basis of a phenotype, but on the treatment they routinely receive, always negative, excluding, and marginalizing, and the unattainable citizenship they embody. In other words, this category of black people must include non-whites and at times non-Christians. The problem then lies in the self-definitions of those groups and the particular forms of blackness they articulate. In that, a new question arises, that of the inescapable hegemony of the discourse and theory developed around race as it has been developed in the Americas in general and in the United States of America in particular, with the centrality occupied by the history of the slave trade and slavery, along with the importance of phenotype-based racism. Afropia, Black Europe, is in the making undoubtedly. Increasing numbers of people of color, indigenously European, have become visible in the late 30 years or so. But Black Europe has yet to fully materialize. It lacks cohesion. It has mostly set out to search for commonalities instead of accepting the beauty of heterogeneity. So to conclude, personally, I believe that at the dawn of the modern times, enslaved populations from the African continent, but then not referring to themselves as Africans or blacks, were taken to the Americas to provide cheap labor. We all know here that this is a euphemism. They were massively and most of the time forcefully displaced to the Americas through the terrorizing Middle Passage to provide free labor. That scattering produced black populations and the invention of the idea of Africa. That scattering has furthered and intensified a movement of populations that today fully and physically encompass the European continent and nation states such as France. This rather novel significant presence within metropolitan France calls for a redefinition of citizenship, belonging, and full inclusion. Old models and foundations cannot stand any longer, but they are mighty, powerful, and have proved throughout history not to be so interested in lofty notions of equality, justice, freedom, and the likes.
Dr. Mabula Sumahora at a workshop on Black Folk in Dark Times at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. Profits are booming for private corporations in Georgia's criminal justice system. Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
A bill passed by both houses of the state legislature landed on the desk of Georgia Governor Nathan Deal last weekend. Georgia House Bill 837 is reportedly the result of about $500,000 in lobbying expenses by a single company, Sentinel Offender Services. The new law greatly expands the profitability and the impact of these private predatory probation companies upon the lives of poor families in Georgia. Back in the 1990s, Georgia farmed out all its misdemeanor probation services to private companies. So when somebody gets a DUI or a similar offense, or misses a traffic court date, and is sentenced to pay a $500 fine plus court costs, and cannot immediately produce the money, that person's case is handed over to a private company, which immediately doubles or triples the amount extracted to cover its own profits and costs and interest. Private probation outfits can get the person sent to jail for late payment or non-payment, effectively a punitive tax upon the poor. This is why Georgia has for some time led the nation in the combined proportion of its residents in prisons, jails, and under court and community and correctional supervision of all kinds, an astounding 1 in 13 Georgia adults. Like all privatized government functions, whether it's privatized parking, privatized voting machines, or privatized education, the privatized probation racket needs to keep the prying eyes of the public off itself. Accordingly, the new legislation creates a dark zone, specifically shielding local governments and the privatizers from revealing how much money is actually remitted to local governments, how much they keep for themselves, how many cases they handle yearly, per caseworker, or at any one time, or how long they keep the cases active. HB 837 legalizes the up till now illegal but common practice of charging probationers for their own electronic monitoring and other costs related to the handling of their cases, forcing the offender and her family to pay for their own continuing house arrest. That's why the model is called offender-funded services. Late payers can be jailed, of course, and time spent in jail under the new law does not count toward completion of your probation. Even now, persons are being locked up because they cannot afford the cost of landlines for their electronic monitoring gear. It's not quite 19th century debtor's prison, a situation in which any creditor could demand you serve time for the crime of not being able to pay. So far, the probation companies will be the only ones with this power, but it is a long step backward. Georgia is one of those states which claims it's reducing the number of folks in its prisons and jails, not because mass incarceration is unjust or discriminatory, but because it costs the states and counties too much. Funneling increasing numbers into punitive house arrest situations under the supervision of privatized middlemen who extract their profits directly from those on probation seems to be a solution state authorities think we can all live with. Whether you live in Georgia or not, it's time to call Georgia Governor Nathan Deal at 404-656-1776. That's 404-656-1776. And ask him whether he wants his state to continue to lead the nation in how many residents it has under correctional and court supervision. How many is too many? The present 1 in 13? Is the governor reaching for 1 in 12? Maybe for 1 in 10? Politely suggest that Governor Deal veto HB 837 and look for ways instead to curtail and to shrink the private predatory probation industry instead of expanding it. His number again is 404-656-1776.
Bruce Dixon, managing editor of Black Agenda Report. It's been 50 years since President Lyndon Johnson signed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, sizes up the civil rights situation from his vantage point in Frankville State Prison in Pennsylvania.
If the national media is to be believed, we are now at the 50-year mark of black civil rights, marked by the 1964 passage of the Civil Rights Act, signed into law by the late President Lyndon B. Johnson. While it is true that this happened, it is also true that for millions of blacks in America, these are not the best of times. For the black bourgeoisie, it has been a rush of opportunity and entree into doors once long closed to them. For the black poor and working class, this is, in the words of legal scholar Michelle Alexander, the new Jim Crow. They are, she argues, a dark caste who are subjected to targeting, imprisonment, and lack of legal rights that makes mass incarceration in America the phenomenon that stymies the hopes and dreams of millions. For them, civil rights is as ancient and as distant as Reconstruction. They cannot drive in peace. They cannot shop in peace. They cannot walk the streets in peace without some cop threatening them for walking while black. For these millions, what can civil rights really mean? They listen to their leaders and are forced to wonder, what world are they talking about? They feel little elation as politicians and corporate propagandists praise events of 50 years ago while their daily lives are lived in hell. The promises of civil rights are lost in the networks of repression that poisons their days and shadows their twilights. For them, the new Jim Crow ain't so new after all.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.